Today's program is brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is November 2014. We're doing a special recording at the Spiegelau Showroom in Manhattan. We're debuting the new Spiegelau Wheat Glass. We have special guests Laura Bell and John Mallett from Bell's Brewery, amongst other guests. So thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to GreatBrewers.com for being our sponsor. This is a special recording in November 2014. So some of our special guests, Matthew from Spiegelau, this is the third specialized beer glass that you guys have made. Tell us a little bit about this one in particular, because we have the stout glass and the IPA glass that was really successful.
The wheat glass was an original idea that came along once we identified some of the major craft beer styles. Really, it's a timing issue trying to scale these things through one at a time, because it takes almost a year for each glass project. But for sure, wheat is, I don't know whether I would consider it emerging, but certainly it's understood outside of the United States as well, so that had a particular appeal for us, because Spiegelau is a global brand, and so we're trying to elevate this concept of American craft beer around the world. So this was kind of a bridge beer style, similar to stout, to kind of get the global attention to the subject.
So we have some of the leaders in craft beer in New York here with us. James Tai, a Cicerone, Brendan Woodcock from Taurus and Luxus, and a Cicerone, and Justin Phillips from Beer Table Pantry. I mean, you guys, you know, you're at the top of your game in New York City. What's the importance of glassware in craft beer? James, you want to?
Well, I mean, when we look at craft beer, there's so many different styles, and each style has a specific characteristic, which you want to somewhat highlight. And I think the development of glassware is something that is able to kind of match that and maximize what we get out of the experience.
You know, Brendan, you took the Master Cicerone exam. Do they have any part of that dedicated to glassware or tasting aspects of glassware?
Certainly various parts. Whenever talking about styles, you probably want to mention glassware, because, of course, the impact of each style is going to be changed by the glassware. And there's also a beer and food section, so that as well, you choose the appropriate glassware. Presentation is important, not just for the flavor and aroma, but also for the perception. So it was definitely part of the test.
And Justin, in your old beer table, you were always a leader in glassware, and you poured large bottles into glassware. You were not the typical pub. Why was that such an important part of your early place?
Honestly, for me, it wasn't a science. I don't have a 500-year history of developing glassware or anything, but for me, it was always about experimenting and trying new things and seeing what works, and, you know, using glassware for the sake of experiencing beer at different temperatures and things like that.
So these are our beer experts, and we're here with the leading glassware guy in the world, Matthew. But John and Laura, you guys from Bell's Brewery, we love having you in New York. The rollout in February was one of the best things that happened in New York City in a long time for craft beer. So tell us a little bit about how you guys got involved with working with Spiegelau on this project.
Sure. So Matt actually contacted me. I think we might have met and chatted about it. And Mallett and I went out to do a workshop in Portland just to check things out, see what this was all about, and had the opportunity to taste through a lot of different glassware with a number of different beers from around the country. And it was very enlightening and something that I think we both got excited about to see where this led to.
That's partially accurate. I was stalking you, actually. Being a huge fan of Bell's.
We'll just forget that part,
Being a huge fan of Bell's. But yeah, we did connect at the Craft Brewers Conference and talked about it, and just was thrilled that there was an interest, and we were able to get the project completed.
Why was wheat the next glass? Because you had IPA and stout, totally different styles.
Yeah, well, we started with IPA because when we hatched the idea to do varietal-specific or style-specific beer glasses, I mean, IPA is a dominant style within the craft beer category. So to us, it was like making the first Cabernet Sauvignon glass for the wine industry. You know, it seemed like a logical first choice. The reception was huge. We rolled the dice. We weren't sure whether people were going to look at this and say, what is this weird-looking glass, and would anybody use it? Turns out to be our number one in terms of velocity SKU for sales at retail. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, outsells our Cabernet Sauvignon glasses, so it's a real kind of testament to the power of craft beer, first of all. The stout, like you said, we were getting input from outside the United States, our friends in the UK in particular, and in Scandinavia, where the style is huge and we do big business. So it was a logical second step. And then wheat, for me, is a personal favorite. I think it's under-promoted, really. Bell's, as I was telling Laura last night at the event, is truly the leader in the field. The first time I drank an Oberon was a transcendental experience, to put it mildly. Made me a lifelong fan of the brewery. And I think that its time is come. It's just a great beer. You see people gravitating towards not necessarily over-the-top and intense flavored beers, and this is a great avenue to enter craft.
John, what do you think about this glass? I mean, this is your this is the Winter White Ale from Bell's. Tell us about how the beer tastes to you, and how, is it different in this glass than in other glasses?
Yeah, well, beer tastes good, but that's not usually a problem for me, you know? do I think the beer tastes different in this glass? Yeah, I do. I absolutely do.
You can hear that little tinny special.
I'm a huge glassware nerd to begin with. As my wife said the other day, you know, you're really fussy about glassware. I said, well, we're not connected with this. And I thought, I am. And I think the reason for that is that so much of my beer drinking experience is engaged in all the senses. Somehow drinking beer out of a can, although I'll certainly do it, you put it in a glass and you get to see the full range of senses, color, even just the sound of that of clinking glasses together is great.
Let's do that again. That's pretty awesome. So what is it about these glasses, Matthew, that makes them sound like that?
Well, this isn't
like a typical Libby pint glass.
No. It's lead-free crystal. It's crystalline. It's a wholly different physical material than you would see in a typical pint glass. So we can blow it very, very thin, which is good because the thinness helps preserve the temperature of the beer, thus preserving the CO2 in the mouthfeel. But it has a strength because it's pure crystal, so it can bounce. It's flexible. So this is what gives it this kind of sound. And when it's full and you clink together, there's no clink. There's more like a whoosh kind of sound. It's pretty wild.
It's pretty awesome. I mean, it's pretty cool having you guys here. I mean, for John, like, you got a book coming out about malt.
Yeah.
You know, how did you get started? I mean, you're, and why are you guys identified with wheat beer? You know, which is pretty big questions.
I think the reason why, you know, Bell's got started with wheat beer is that, you know, Bell's has been around for, Larry Bell was certainly pioneer in the whole craft segment. And he was making beers that were wholly unlike any other beers out there. I mean, beers were hazy, they weren't filtered. People kind of looked at that and said, like, beers are hazy, it isn't right. And somehow they started selling, and somehow they started doing okay. And I think that when you make that style, when you make a style of beer that's unfiltered, you're picking up much more from yeast, you're leaving a lot of protein there, and it all builds to this beautiful body. It builds to this rich, round, smooth experience. The place where, you know, with one of the main beers that we do is Oberon. That beer was originally started out at Solson, and that beer has a significant amount of wheat, but unlike Bavarian wheat beers, it is not using a phenolic strain of yeast. So it's kind of a clean ale that captures and picks up and enhances some of the hop character. And so this is a hoppy wheat beer, so you've just got this full range of wheat flavor, which I think of as being slightly bready. We've got these great hop... the hops in that beer are a little bit of citrus to them, have a sort of citrus character, and then the body just brings that whole thing together. It's a really delicate yet full beer. And for whatever reason, that beer's done very well with the craft beer community.
So. And it's been interesting, you know, it's our seasonal beer, so our summer seasonal comes out the week before opening day of baseball and goes through Labor Day, and people, you know, get so excited about it. It's the sign of the end of winter in Michigan. Oberon opening day is what we call it, and people take off work. We throw midnight release parties. And it all developed because that's what our customers asked for. People call me and they say, how did you guys do this? And I say, we had amazing people that got enthusiastic about our beer and really drove it. And we just try to jump on and take care of them. So that organic enthusiasm for wheat beer is something that we're super proud of as well.
What do you guys think about Bell's and their wheat beers?
Oh, they're, I mean, what can I say?
You're a tasting expert.
Come on, as John didn't already say. I mean, talking about Oberon is great. Also, you know, we're presently drinking the Winter White. That's nice. I'm actually, one of my favorite things about wheat beer is honestly the presentation, which is why it's great to have a good glass for it. But the lacing on wheat, it's like a little bit more protein, so it hangs on the glass longer. The head retention's a little better. You can usually tell it's bright white. And so it just looks sexy. Boersman has that, Winter White, Oberon. It's quite a few. It's really nice.
I'll tell you, full disclosure, this is a special recording. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. It's our first beer of the day. Yesterday we were at the Spiegelau wheat glass tasting at the Brass Monkey in the Meatpacking District, and then some of us went over to a special Michael Jackson beer and spirits inspired tasting of New York State products at Brooklyn Brewery. So it's our first beer of the day, and it's actually a good first beer. So I was thinking, what are we going to have for breakfast?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think this would be my breakfast beer. Have you done that many times, John? Had you had your wheat beer for breakfast?
Of course. It's a huge tradition. I mean, 10 o'clock is the traditional time in Bavaria to have, you know, Weissbier and Weisswurst, you know. So I'm sure that over in all this week, there have been people eating and drinking wheat beer and good sausage products over in Germany.
In our factory, they're drinking beer and eating sausage at 10 o'clock in the morning. And wearing lederhosen. True.
We should do that more.
Yeah. Come on over anytime.
And that's so the Oberon opening day, that sounds like a lot of fun.
It's nuts. I've thrown a party, our midnight release in East Lansing. I went to Michigan State, so that's kind of where I go back to hang. And there's lines out the door, and sometimes it's snowing, and those kids are just so excited. They're not kids, I guess. You know, students are excited, and, you know, midnight hits, and we run through two half barrels, you know, in half an hour.
And that's a school night,
isn't it? And that's a school night, yeah. One night it even fell on Easter, and we sold it out. So it's the enthusiasm's pretty fun. There's people waiting at Bell's at 9 a.m. on Monday morning to get the first taste, and it's a super exciting day. So
I live in Western PA, and at the end of the season, there was a wild run on your product. I mean, where I was like, I'm trying to get the last three cases, four cases, calling around, and you found one. I had four cases at a place called Banksville, and I took them all with me. I hoarded.
Well, it does taste really good in this glass. Justin, do you sell a lot of Bells at Beer Table Pantry?
We do, yeah. Pretty good amount. And I have to admit, like, I really honestly wasn't that familiar with the brand. Of course, I knew it by name, but hadn't personally consumed that much. So when it came to New York, it was really exciting for me to actually get to try these things that, you know, I'd heard enough about. And then to see just, like, the passion of people even in the middle of New York City here. Like,
and your place is different. You're at Grand Central. So yeah. What does the typical customer buy, and how do they consume it?
Typical customer, it's hard to say what type of person it is because it's pretty much anyone and everyone. But most folks buy two cold beers for the train, and lots of folks will have, you know, one standby that's like their favorite. They buy that, and then we try to guide them towards something new for their second beer. And that's, you know, quick rotation keeps it really interesting for them.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you that these are, I've never tried this before. I had the Oberon. What are the other wheat beers that you guys make?
We do an Oersman. That's a light, tart wheat beer. And then we play around with wheat a little bit in some of our specialty beers. We've done a wheat beer series. We did Wheat Love. Mallet maybe can talk a little more about that one if you want to.
Yeah, so, you know, Larry Bell is an incredibly creative person, and you get these interesting directions, and so on this particular one, it was the wheat series. He said, I had this vision that, you know, you can get different wheat malts, and wouldn't it be cool to make a beer with two different wheat malts in it and then pair that with maybe two different hops? And, well, actually, we could use two different yeast sources as well. So this was wheat 2, and building off of wheat 2 was wheat 4, wheat 6, wheat 8, and then came back to Wheat Love. And these beers were all very different, but they all had this similarity in that wheat character. And I think that when you're talking about wheat, and what is that characteristic really, wheat contains more protein than barley and carries through that protein. So you get this both full bodiness from the wheat itself, and you also pick up a lovely, lovely haze, and, you know, the beer just gets, like, opalescent and glowing like this full moon. So I really like playing with wheat a lot.
We have a beer on draft right now. So I was out with a couple of our brewers, and it was midnight, and all of a sudden our phones all get a text, and we look, and it's from my dad, and it's, you know, midnight, and he says, I want a, you know, 80% wheat beer, midnight. I want to call it Bright Size Life and go. And so that's what we have on right now is, you know, a test batch with 80% wheat. So
wheat
around a lot.
Wheat doesn't have a husk. Unlike barley, wheat doesn't have a husk. And so getting it through a louder ton is a bit of a problem. And, you know, there's some skill involved there. And 80% wheat is just kind of audacious.
Yeah.
And it managed to get done, but it wasn't like put the brewery on autopilot and go get lunch, you know.
Yeah.
We have a skilled brewing staff downtown. They managed to do it.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I'll go, you go.
Oh, I was just going to say, Zeke kind of looked at his phone and was like, okay, Larry, sure, you know.
When you make wheat beers, are you doing something, are you malting it differently than barley's and other grains?
Yeah, in the malting process, you know, the malting process, steeping, germinating, and kilning, finally, the issue with wheat is it's got no husk. So barley, when it's going through the malting process, tends to both loft a little bit better. Like it keeps, you need some air circulation through there. So it stays up. Wheat kind of, like rye, kind of gets a little almost sticky and very dense and doesn't want to go through there easily. The other thing that will happen, you know, is it turns into this sticky mass and grows together. If you're not getting that airflow, then it's more difficult to make it consistently. So there is some skill involved with making wheat malt itself. At that point, when you're done with making the steeping and germination part, then you're into kilning. And in that kilning phase, you can do all kinds of different things to either wheat or barley. So you could make it dark or light, or you could allow it to acidify up or not. And so you have the full range of sort of kilning conditions available to you in wheat as you do in barley. Just a little bit more difficult to work with in the malt house.
That's pretty awesome. This is a great little first segment. I'm going to take a few minutes. We'll be back on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
So, you like good beer. Whether you're a craft beer pro or just had your first sip of an IPA, GreatBrewers.com is your number one beer resource on the internet. GreatBrewers.com bridges the gap between the world's great brewers and the consumers who enjoy their products. With so much information and misinformation out there, GreatBrewers.com focuses on education and leaves no stone unturned. Take the Great Beer Test on their website and browse through an extensive product catalog. Download their mobile Beer Cloud app, which includes a GPS beer finder, a beer sommelier, and descriptions for over 5,000 different brews. What are you waiting for? Back up that passion for craft beer with some solid information and education. Visit GreatBrewers.com today.
Hey, 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 welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special recording, November 2014. We're at the Spiegelhaus Showroom in Manhattan, New York City. So we got some great guests here, John and Laura from Bell's, Matthew from Spiegelhaus, and some of our beer experts. So Justin Phillips from Beer Table, what were you just talking about? The mid-segment, you know, chatter was pretty interesting.
Laura was just saying last night that they've been traveling a lot, and I know they're here briefly, but I was curious to know how long they're going to stay in town.
Yeah, so we're kind of in and out. We had some travel complications over the last couple of days, and finally made it here.
The plane caught fire.
It was canceled and late, and it was, you know, pretty humorous. But John and I do well traveling together through that, so, yeah. We're up in Michigan's Upper Peninsula earlier this week. We opened a small brewery up there, so did the grand opening, and then came to New York City. It's a little bit of a culture shock, I'd say.
There's a lot of loyalty for your beer, isn't there?
There is, and it's impressive and overwhelming, and sometimes I try to wrap my head around, you know, how people feel about it, and it's a little bit challenging because it's so special, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead. I was just, you mentioned a new brewery. Is that up Traverse City?
No. Okay, so like, those
it's
of you
hand,
can't see,
right?
So here's our hand, right? Here's Michigan, here's the Upper Peninsula. It's here in Escanaba, just on Lake Michigan. So it's a small 20-barrel brew house, and it's called Upper Hand Brewing. We're making all different beers, different brands, and it's a fun project to step away from Bell's a little bit and try something different.
Well, that's great. So the first segment, John, you were talking about how you malt the wheat for the wheat beers. You have a book coming up, The Malt, a practical guide for field to brew house. Tell us about that and how that book came about.
Sure. The genesis of the book is that the Brewers Association, the publishing segment of the Brewers Association called Brewers Publications, has a series of books that they've been doing on beer elements. So this is the raw materials in beer, water, yeast, hops, and malt is the last one. So they asked me if I would be interested in writing it. I thought, sure, you know, I know a lot about malt, but do you know everything? And it would be just a good codified way to go through and kind of check that off. It also, you know, I've got a fairly busy job. I got wife, kids, family, and whew, I got my butt kicked, you know. But it's been really good. I went pretty far down the rabbit hole and learned a lot about malt, and hopefully imparted that some of that to, you know, everybody from somebody who's just started the home brewing to maybe somebody who's been brewing professionally for, you know, 20 plus years picks something up as well.
Seems that a lot more people are interested in malt, and you know, some people may feel like they've had too many hops in their beer and they're asking for malt forward beers. I mean, you experience this a lot, James?
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking, I don't want to say trends, but there's always kind of like a certain style or a certain beer that kind of like sets the tone for whatever particular time. A while back, it was IPAs. Everything had to be, you know, four-digit IBUs or however high you can go, right? Obviously not four digits, but I think now that you've seen that trend where it's kind of like come back the other direction, I guess you would say session beers or low alcohol. You know, those are the beers that are kind of like, you know, taking they're setting the pace right now, I'd say.
Well, it's eye-opening drinking this wheat, because I felt like for a while I used to drink Hefeweizens and some Wits, and then everyone kind of went, that palate, I feel like we're all drinking sour beers for a while. Mm-hmm. But more customers are asking me, they're talking about a malty beer, and I don't really even know how to put my finger on that, because there's not too many lagers that are available like that. And I don't know what you guys think in the market, but do you think maybe that wheat beers like this are ready for a comeback? You know, for just filling that niche?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you had mentioned sours. I think it's still really thriving right now. While we're talking about wheat, Berliner Weiss is probably, if not our most rapidly turning line, it's up there straight with Pilsner. And, you know, personally, just my own preference, it's not quite going all the way towards malt, but, you know, in somewhat lighter beers, I think Pilsners are... It's funny to say from a craft perspective that they're going to make a comeback, because they haven't gone anywhere. They're still dominating the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of drinkers are coming full circle. You know, they've had the IPAs, they've had the stouts, and now they want to come back to something that's like crafted well, balanced, appropriate amount of each ingredient, you know, everything kind of in harmony.
And I mean, just kind of a little bit on that as well with the malt part is just that I think what's exciting, too, is you have, like, you know, this new breed of craft, well, I don't know, like, you know, small batch maltsters. And mm-hmm. So you're going to start seeing a lot more characteristics coming out of those particular raw materials, you know, expressing themselves in the finished product. You know, so we're going to see something close to, like, terroir for craft beer.
John, as you've, like, made beers and wheat beers in particular, did you look to any other styles, like German wheat beers or anything, as inspiration?
I'll drink anything, man.
Or is it just Michigan inspired? I mean,
no. I mean, I think that as you drink around the world, you notice certain flavors. You think like that's a really interesting place that brewer started to go. Do I want to take that a little further? Do I want to incorporate some element into that? And you know, I think a good example of that is the Oarsman that we've got. Oarsman, it was a beer that. The vision for that really came on a hot summer day at a beer festival when somebody was trying to, you know, hand you a 10%+ alcohol, you know, as you say, quadruple digit BU beer, and you know, try this, and you think, God, I just need a rotary tongue scraper about now because my palate's damn near shot and I'm, you know, half in the bag. So looking at that beer, trying to think about a beer, what could work? What could work as this great like. Palate cleansing thing, and that comes back to German wheat styles, and the German wheat style of Berliner Weiss has got a really nice tart acidity to it, and so we kind of played with that and changed it around a fair amount. We were not trying to make a Berliner Weiss, but came up with something kind of wholly unique, and it's been lovely. I mean, you know, I walk through Beer Festival now, and the number of brewers you see that are just like making a beeline over there to have, you know, have a quick little palate cleanse and a delicious beer at that. I think wheat brings a lot of functionality to that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's kind of a rambling answer to your question.
Well, we're kind of rambling. It's okay. Justin almost knocked over the table. We're in this showroom at Spiegelhof. Can people come here, Matthew, and visit?
Yes, it's open to the public during our trade weeks, which is the second week of April. It's called New York Tabletop Market, and the second week of October. So this is when generally this showroom supports our restaurant on-premise business in New York, so you know people like yourselves can come and check it out, do tastings. But also our retail business is supported here, so you know our Bloomingdale's and our Macy's and friends like that come
Let's
here.
Let's do a toast. If you like glassware, this is the place to come, I'll tell you. Yeah.
So if you hold it by the base here. Here's where you're going to get the real ring.
Ooh.
It's a mammoth experience.
I know, I'd be too afraid, like, they do feel more
delicate. So they're real sturdy,
you know?
Too, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, let's talk about that, because this is, whenever people see these, and we have three, you know, just professionals that work in on-premise trade, Spiegelau is a restaurant hotel glass. I mean, we're the largest producer of fine glassware for restaurants and hotels in the world, so, I mean, every day they're used at the Four Seasons hotels in the peninsula. I mean, some pretty nice places. Restaurateurs like Mario Batali and Wolfgang Puck use Spiegelau. Of course, our brewery partners use them too. So, I mean, they're durable glass. They're dishwasher safe. That's the important thing. I like to get that message out because people are like, oh, I have to hand wash them. I'm like, truth is, people tend to break glasses when they hand wash them because usually they're washing them at the end of the night after they've had a couple of these 10% alcohol beers or whatever. And they tend to overhandle things. So it's just best to put them in the dishwasher, and they're good to go.
That's pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think this is a really, I would describe it as a very elegantly modern design. You know, I'm just curious, how the process came about of designing this particular glass, if you guys can talk about that.
Sure. So we met up in Portland, actually, at one of the Rogue public houses, which was...
It was during the Oregon Brewers Festival.
Yeah, which was fun. And Matt and George brought a number, you know, I think it was 12 different glasses, maybe.
Yes.
And glassware like I've never seen before. You know, different designs, very unique, very very special. And we brought a bunch of different wheat beers and tasted through each of them. And at the end, we'd, you know, rank them and then pull out the ones that maybe weren't as successful with wheat beer. And at the end of it, we ended up all unanimously saying, gosh, this glass really makes wheat beer shine.
Yeah, well, we had a core bowl shape that was coming out of there because there's certain limitations to our machinery, just like there's certain limitations of what you can brew, there's certain limitations of what you can actually make. And I think what was most interesting was we were all kind of, we're instructed to not have visual prejudices or preconceived notions of how the glass should perform, and just let the, you know, the appearance, the aroma, the taste, the mouthfeel, and the finish, you know, if they're elevated, this is what you want to be supporting in the elimination process. And I think, I know me personally, I was always looking at these types of beers as being, you know, when I relate them to wine, which for whatever reason some people do, more like a Sauvignon Blanc or Riesling, therefore needing a smaller glass. But really the small glasses, the small bowls we use were mm-hmm. all eliminated quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been using this comparison because this bowl is quite voluminous. It's quite big. And I joke about that that giant radio telescope down in Puerto Rico that was in that movie where you need this big bowl to catch these faint, you know, signals, you know what I'm talking about, and really amplify them. And so I think this big bowl here really helps elevate these more.
We can talk to aliens when we do.
Well,
let's do that one more time. Let's do that one more time.
After a couple of
yeah, let's.
So that's the alien.
Three or
code.
Four more of these. Yeah. So look at this as like a radio telescope. I mean, a big bowl really catching these signals and harnessing them.
Well, the beer's tasting better after I have more than one or two.
Yeah, I mean, you notice as it sits in the glass, I mean, it just there's this kind of entire aromatic atmosphere going on in here.
I mean, I'm sold on your glassware. I mean, we sat through the IPA when we did the IPA glass test tasting thing years ago. You guys guided us through 10 or 12 different glasses, and Mr. George Rito was inspiring the way he talked about. You know, he ended up kind of guiding us. I feel like he had already them picked out, and he guided us to the one that he wanted because he was such a master. But it was pretty cool.
You know, I people can have that perception. I mean, he's my boss. I report to him. But, you know, on the projects that we have when I work with him one-on-one, you know, he sits here, and his eyes light up, and he gets incredibly fired up about the subject, and let alone the shipping charges to send Bell's Oberon over to Austria more than five or six times. You know, our controller's like, well, what's this bill? I'm like, don't worry about it. It was for George Rito. So he has a real affinity for the process, and now he has a real love for the beer and the brand Bell's as well.
Well, today, also talking about wheat, I mean, we're talking, I do think that there's more room for wheat. Like we said, there's stouts and IPAs, and people have talked for more malty beers. And talking to you, John, you know, what are some other styles of malt forward beers that you think consumers would like? Or the directions you might go.
Well, I think, you know, when you talk about malt, it's the soul of beer. It's you know, you look at beer and you think, what's in there? There's water, there's hops, and there's malt, and then yeast. So what's that malt contributing? What are these, each individual one contributing? Well, the malt contributes, aside from the color, the alcohol, the extract, and the body, malt's not doing anything. You know, aside from those, you know, couple minor things in beer. I mean, those are huge pieces. And if you, you know, if you, as a brewer, occasionally we'll make up a hop tea to assess a hop varietal. You know, you put hops in water and you get some sense of it, and it's undrinkable. So malt brings the balance to any beer, and just how high that's elevated really kind of defines how malty that beer is. I think that also with malt, you've got this incredible range of characteristics. So, you know, everything from a dark malt, which is going to give this, you know, great astringency and beautiful color, on down to something like in a Pilsner, where although the malt is sort of subdued, it's hanging out there. There's some hops, but the malt component is so critical for balance. So when I think about malty beer, it's funny. I actually think of some pretty pale beers, beers that you may not think. I mean, you drink some of the just beautiful, well constructed Pilsners in Germany, you know, like the German Pils, where there's just this, you know, sure there's a little hop crack there, but that crack of the hop is really supported by this just delicious malty base. So what's a malty beer? They're all malty beers. There's my answer for you.
All right, man. What about you guys? Do you have any questions for John or Laura about, you know, what they're doing?
I actually did about the development of the glassware. Going back to it, I kind of wanted to know, I mean, it's great to hear the context that Oberon was shipped over multiple times, and so it was clearly developed in context and in conjunction with Bell's, but I'm wondering how much of an influence traditional wheat glassware had on the development of this one. Like, typically when I picture, German wheat, it's mm-hmm. like, Stein, mm-hmm. And if I'm picturing like a Belgian whip beer, then it might have like a bulb way at the top and a skinny.
Well,
kind of
it's, thank you for asking. It's a great question because in the original assortment, the first 12, I mean, we'd worked from about 60 glasses down to 12, and we included our non-workshopped Hefeweizen glass because people have this traditional kind of association with that glass, and it worked pretty well with a Bavarian Hefeweizen. And similarly, we included a more Belgian-identified shape. But again, you know, a lot of times these glasses that exist were just created for the sake of this looks good. There wasn't any type of thought to how to really enhance the beer's performance overall. And in many ways, in particular, the traditional Hefeweizen glass, you know, the story goes that it was a visual cue. So everyone was looking at the visuals and the longer glass to see the delicate bead and everything else. But we included them, and we used not just Oberon and winter wheat. We used some other breweries' wheat beers as well. Mm-hmm. They were simply eliminated by consensus. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the message that we're bringing forward, that, you know, traditional shapes are great for what they are. You know, when I go to Germany and Bavaria, of course I have my own glassware, but if I'm going to walk into, you know, a beer hall in Bavaria, I'm not going to tell them that their glass is wrong. You know, sometimes you when in Rome, you do how you do it. But when you have a chance to control what you're doing, particularly at home or in your restaurant, and you can elevate the experience, why not do it?
That's true, man.
Yeah, I think... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, I mean, I assume a big part of the objective was for it to be versatile among the mm-hmm. vast range of wheat beers that are out there.
It has to be. Yes. I mean, because, you know, we had to answer this question with respect to both stout, of which there is a dizzying array of stouts within the category, same with IPA. You know, this first time around, I say we're a 500-year-old company. You know, 500 years from now, will people understand what we're doing? Hopefully. But, you know, it's what we're really doing is just elevating above the current status quo, which is, by and large, the pint glass, which is, frankly, a disaster for serving these types of beers.
Yeah.
So above anything above that, you know, when we made the prototypes for this glass, there was 5 different versions of this. Each one of them was light years ahead of what had existed before. So we are splitting hairs to get to this. But yeah, it's really compare them against what people normally drink out of and people understand what we're doing.
I'm sorry.
Interrupting. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back on Beer Sessions Radio.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hey, 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 welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special recording at the Spiegel Hourglass Showroom, and we're talking about malts and wheat and special glasses. John Mallett, the brewer from Bell's. What are you going to say, buddy?
Oh, what I was going to say is, you know, I look at functionally what's happening in a beer and, the, you know, sort of the whole, the way that we experience it. So, you know, if I drink beer out of a can or a bottle, then, you know, I'm getting certain aromas and certain flavors out of there. But when you pour beer into a glass, I think a couple of very interesting things happen. So the first of which is that, you know, beer has got this mixture inside of it of hydrophilic and hydrophobic components. So hydrophilic, water-loving, hydrophobic, water-hating. And when you pour the beer, you make an act of separation. The foam, because there's less water in there, there's more gas, it's got these great hydrophobic components. And these have a very different properties. There's a little more bitterness up there. The second thing you're doing is, as the beer is poured in there, the CO2 starts to break out of solution. And all the time the beer is in the glass, the CO2 is evolving. And as it's moving through the liquid column, it's grabbing a hold of a huge range of flavor active, highly flavor active gases, and bringing them up to the top of the beer. So when I pour a beer into a glass, and the glass has enough space, that those aromas are carried up, and they are sort of retarded or retained in that headspace. I think about the difference between drinking, say, a really fine brandy. I pour a really fine brandy in a proper snifter, and there's this constant evolution of flavors, and you get this, you get your nose down in there, and you get this aroma. That's very different than, you know, having a shot of brandy. You know, the shot of brandy, you just don't get that chance to have it evolve. So I think having a glass where there's actually like enough space for the beer to kind of relax and breathe is really key. And I think that's where this glass really shines, is that it's got space to throw ahead, it's got space to release some of these compounds, and it's got space to just gather them. So when you get your, you know, first step of putting that beer, you bring that beer right up to your mouth, and oh, surprise, your nose is in there. I mean, you're bathing your nose in these fantastic aromas. So again, it is kind of like that radio telescope. Mm-hmm.
Justin, what were you going to say? You almost knocked over the table.
Yeah. So violent. No, I was going to say, actually, again, I have to make an admission. The first time I tasted this beer was on Tuesday. And every Tuesday, Megan and I, the manager of the Grand Central store, sit down and we taste a few things that are new to us. And we always use, you probably know the name, but the little wine tasting glass. It's a little stemmed, tiny glass that,
Is it one of our products?
It's not.
I think what they would call it is a citation glass. This is,
I don't know.
It's from an unnamed competitor.
It's a small glass. That's the reason we use it for tasting, because it's tiny. But tasting that beer out of that then is a totally different experience than tasting out of this. It's nice to have the comparison, because honestly, I didn't know quite what to think.
I mean, for me, just at my place, Jimmy's number 43, we only have two glasses right now, which is, I'm not proud of. We have a pint glass and we have a wine glass. And I always drink everything out of the wine glass. Just going from the wine glass to the pint glass, the tastes are, you know, it's amazing difference. And we get stuck sometimes in terms of programs. I keep talking about how I want to get beyond using the pint glass. And we used to have more of an English style, you know, thinner, larger 20 ounce glass. But it's kind of the industry thing too. Like, we're kind of stuck where we're getting pint glasses and, you know, we want to break out of it.
We'll send a salesperson down later today. Special deal. Yeah, I mean, this is a thing. You know, people, when we're introducing the glass to the on-premise channel, I mean, it's, people have their practical reasons for what they have. What we do is introduce the glass. It's a different consideration for them a lot of times, specifically from a price point. But when you overcome these typical objections about price and, you know, durability and whatnot, you know, and people, even if they integrate a few of the glasses slowly into a program to see how the guests react, it's really worth the investment. I mean, people really, really respond positively to drinking out of a nicer glass.
Talk about nice glass programs. How do you guys do it at Torst and Luxus, Brendan?
Well, from the very start, we just had what people would call wine glasses and served beer in them. And I think really that everything that we've talked about, the value of stemware and from the presentation all the way through to how you perceive the flavor, really informed the customer experience. And we do a pretty speedy business with those glasses coming in and then going out of the door. it's a cool design as well, but I think that beer people are happy to go to a place, get a cool glass that they can say, all right, this is a beer glass. And something's maybe just different about that. It might be shaped exactly like a wine glass.
Yeah.
But they can own it in that space.
I think something that's exciting for us, too, when I think about Oberon, it is, you know, since it's a summer seasonal, it's turned into that beer you bring camping or on the river. You know, you throw a couple cans in the cooler, and that's definitely an appropriate way to drink it. And it's also nice now to have a glass that elevates that maybe changes the perception of a wheat beer as it is a sessionable beer. It is great to you know, take and integrate into your life, but having something that elevates it, that brings it that importance, is something that's super exciting as well. So, yeah, something I think about.
And I think just the experience itself, the sensory experience about drinking this beer. And I honestly feel privileged to be sitting at this table because I'm respect immensely like a lot of the palates that are sitting here right now. So I just want to throw it out. What are you guys picking up that's different drinking out of this glass versus if you're drinking out of like a regular shaker pint?
Good question.
I just want to throw it out. Yeah.
For me, it's like for me in a lot of ways, it's like removing a layer of wax paper mm-hmm. from over a painting. Like, you know, you can kind of see the painting, but when you pull that off, when you clean the windows, it's just bam and bright. And that, for me, has been the experience with the beer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say the pitch on these is becoming more clear in the third iteration, where, I mean, I think it's pretty short and sweet. This is, like, all about aroma for me, and that's the thing.
But, Justin, at beer table, you never had pint glasses.
I did.
You did?
Yeah.
Did?
We had
that's why you're on the show, man. Come on.
No. I never had a shaker pint, but I had, you know, we had a hand pump, and so, yeah, I was pouring into a 20-ounce Imperial pint.
So you got a nicer Imperial
pint. For certain cascales. And
yeah.
It was
thinner
fun, and I like that tradition. I still mm-hmm. like the idea of, I mean, I will probably never fully subscribe to this, and I mean that in the nicest way, because mm-hmm. I love seeing the beautiful old traditional wheat beer glass side by side with this, and that's sort of how I've always seen my menu, is like contrasting the old tradition next to this. Mm-hmm. And I don't include shaker pint. But I do think, you know, this is far superior for our tasting experience, and I think this glass of the three that have come out so far, I would actually use as a tasting glass mm-hmm. for a couple ounces of almost anything. So, and that leads me to a question, is that something that might ever happen?
It's
like
a
general tasting glass, because there are a lot of us who do a lot of tasting, but not necessarily a lot of drinking of a whole beer.
Yes. It's in our skunk works right now,
okay,
currently, because there's a big question out there. I mean, I know Ray Daniels well from the Cicerone, and we were talking about it, is that, you know, especially in the industry, because people are moving from brewery to brewery or whatnot, but, you know, in a tasting room and brewery X might have this glass, and tasting room and sensory lab over here is this glass, so, you know, you go to a gas pump, there's a stamp on it for the Bureau of Weights and Measures, so you know when you get a gallon, you're getting a gallon. So this doesn't exist, interestingly, in this kind of esoteric realm of judging. And so therefore, if there's no standard, it's hard to create this concept that we are all having the same experience. So, yeah, we're working on this idea, but again, there's some functional issues here because that's not something I perceive to be a huge consumer product. And,
no.
You know, when we make these things, they have to go somewhere.
Yeah.
So, and when we make them, we make 40,000 at a time.
Yeah.
So we need a group
of...
Well,
I can't commit to that.
Yeah.
I will
we can split, right?
We're hoping when we get to this, I mean, it might be a thing where we have, you know, 100 breweries take a portion of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, just so it's out there. So everybody knows, okay, we're all drinking out of the same glass. We're all speaking the same language. That's a long-term goal. And
yeah,
same for
I think
the
for retailers
judging.
And for staff training and everything, it would be amazing. And
yeah, and I think about it, you know, beer tourism certainly around our area has skyrocketed, and you can tell by the number of tasters that we serve on a weekend.
Right.
You know, it used to be a couple, and now that's all anybody gets.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing they're going to have in their first experience with Bell's, maybe. You know, we serve them in a little 5-ounce straight-sided taster, and so to have something that you know, gives them the real or more of the idea of what we're going for would be exciting.
Yes, yeah. We're working on that. But in the meantime, with something like this, you know, this wheat glass, you know, it'd be interesting to get comments from Laura and John on what their feelings are in the beer and how it smells and tastes, and then you can relate to their customer that, mm-hmm. hey, you may have it in a pint over this pub over here, you may have it over here, but if you want to have a virtual drinking session with me, you know, and we're you know, talking about the beer, pick up one of these glasses and drink it, and then we're speaking the same language. Mm-hmm. So,
you need the same, if you're like in different parts of the country, you need the same beer that was bottled on the same date in the same glass, really, to taste it, right?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's sharing a virtual experience. And the bigger point here, and this is what drives me crazy, because I'm definitely on the brewer side of the equation when it comes to people and judging and reviewing and everything else, because people are real sworn, you know, they have things to say on the internet, so to speak. I would
they
say,
do?
Yes, they no do. Way. But the thing that drives me crazy is that, you know, Fred from Terre Haute can drink a winter wheat in a pint glass and give it a C, when Jane in White Plains drinks it out of this and gives it an A+, and the aggregate score is a B-. Okay, what does that do for anybody? Nothing.
Yeah. Let's stop rating beers online. Let's talk about things we can measure.
What I'm saying is, in this particular instance, if you want to drink a Bell's beer in particular or a wheat beer and you want to have the best experience, we have experts that got together and took a long time to bring it to market. So you want to give a wheat its best chance, put it in here.
That's great. Just looking at your bottle, John, so this date on here, 10/18/14, is that the bottle date?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's, you always put bottle on dates on your bottle.
Yep.
That's great. We've talked about that. I mean, talking about measuring, you know, I think we've had talks about, you know, whether it's Best Buy or bottle on, but, you know, definitely we can do all agree that freshness is important too, so...
Yeah,
but that's unique. I mean, is everyone putting their bottle dates on their bottles?
Is everyone doing it?
Yeah.
No. There's no standard there. We just feel like you know, trying to be transparent to the beer lover is important for us.
Absolutely, you know? And it holds different people accountable for freshness of our beer as well. You know, with our wholesalers, with our retail partners, to make sure that they're, you know, rotating properly and getting that through. So it's
It's kind of dumb, but I think about milk, and it always expires on. So I was like, wait a minute, we're drinking the October 18th, 2014 beer in November. That's pretty good. But
yeah, but I mean, if you have expired on a milk, when was it bottled? Like, how fresh is it really? You don't really know that,
yeah.
You know? And with this, I think it's a very, you know, tangible piece. There's certain beers that we make that, you know, you look at that number and you think, you know, only 2 months? Oh, why can't we get this a little older? So, you know, some of those big beers want to extend their age, you know, want to have some time in the bottle to really pull together. So I think it's important information for the beer lover to know, to have access to.
I mean, you guys are making great beers. I was reading some things about you. At one point, there was this quote, Michigan style unfiltered stronger beers. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I've never heard that, but it makes sense to me, yeah.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, winters are cold in Michigan. You need a lot to get through there, you know. So.
Yeah.
And again, you know, Larry's been making unfiltered beers, you know, since he couldn't afford a filter, I think, you know. Mm-hmm. And that became, that's really a mark of the styles of beers that we've made for a long time. Mm-hmm. Just a tremendous impact from again the proteins that are held up in the barley or the wheat, making it through all the way to the final end beer. Yeast has a flavor. These flavors become bigger. It's a more bold beer. The downside of this is that we need to handle them carefully, because you know, you let a beer like that go too long, it's not you know, you wouldn't want to put it in the nuclear bunker and, you know, assume it's going to be good, you know, 80 years from now.
Right.
These are fragile, ephemeral things, and by managing that, that's how we get the best experience for our, mm-hmm. for our beer lovers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no, just total agreement, you know, with the exception of Expedition and Old Ale, you know, and when people find those a year old on the shelf and they go, yes, you know, because it's already pre-aged for them, so.
All right. Does anyone have any other questions for these guys? You guys all talked, I got some questions, so. All right, so wheat beer. It's funny, I never thought of Bell's as wheat. I mean, I guess it would be only really, I was exposed to it last winter. So what are some of the other beers that you guys are making? We know the Two-Hearted IPA, but some of the other beers that are stronger that people identify with Bell's?
Well, I think our stouts, you know, we do 5 or 6 different stouts starting in October that show a different range of flavors. Expedition Stout certainly is one of the bigger ones. Certainly,
Matthew likes that.
Yeah, I think in the beer enthusiast community.
I think everybody at this table likes that one. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so that's something that I think that we are really strong at. And then our Amber Ale is something that, that was really the beer that built the brewery. And as we shift to IPAs, I think it is sort of lost favor with some of the beer community. But we talk about malt coming back, and I think that's one that is still strong for us, and we push to try to be stronger as well. So
I keep thinking people, I think that pale ales are coming back. It's been really interesting tasting these wheats because when I first started, and I know Justin used to work for Bee United, the importer, always a core of my beer drinking were really good German beers. Bock beers, Doppelbocks, Dunkel lagers, Dunkel Weizen beers. That's how you got started, and I always think that's one reason we're buddies. But tell us about some of those German beers that you drank and loved that were real malty. They might have been Bock's or something.
Yeah, I mean, there was a pretty big range, and totally different things. But I mean, the first thing I want to do is go home and pour a Schneider Weisse into this, and, you know, see how it works out.
And Schneider has that they have that like World War II recipe, the Edelweiss, which is also like nice malty, and then they have the Aventinus.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and just the original classic Schneider Weisse is, you know, it's sort of grandfather of Hefeweizens. It's a beauty, but yeah, I love those, and I am curious to try them.
And I had an Italer Curator, one of the Doppelbocks, last week,
yep.
And it was so different. I mean, it reminded me, wow, what I love beer. There's so many styles, but it was like malty sweet, but it was so, you know, delicious. I don't know if you guys have anything like that in the works or if
we make a ton of different
a lot
beers.
Of beer.
I mean, it's really
I know.
So the Bell's sort of scene is that we've got some beers that we're doing year round, things like Two Hearted and Amber and Porter. Then we've got some beers that are seasonals, the Winter White, the Oberon. We've got some things that kind of come out, you know, once a year, pop up. And then there's stuff that come out of our pub downtown. Well, the pub downtown, we're making an incredible range of beers down there. So, you know, how far out these get, that varies. You know, most of the stuff made at the pub stays at the pub. Mm-hmm. What aren't we making, you know?
Yeah, I think we made last year on one of our big parties that we do, we tap 63 different beers in a day, so it's pretty fun for us. And I think ultimately we also try to be seasonal about it. I think there's one of the things I like, people always ask, what's your favorite beer? And it's hard to answer that question because beer is so seasonal. And I think for Bell's, we try to brew beers to drink in the season that you should drink them in as well.
So Matthew, you want to wrap it up? Say anything us about this glass?
I saw you.
Is that called sniffing, or how do you describe that process?
Nose in the beer.
Nose in beer.
That was really nice.
He was smiling. He had his nose in the beer, and color came over his face.
I have the service professionals out here, and the one thing I wanted to touch on because it's a big subject is pairing of food and beer. I was in the wine background for a long time. As a sommelier, but when I was stretched to try to serve something with a certain course, oftentimes I would pick a beer, and oftentimes it would be a wheat or Hefeweizen originally before I became introduced to American wheat. I'm interested to know, because from what John said about the mouthfeel and this great creaminess from these proteins, how do you find this as a beer for pairing with food? Is it something you would push, recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess I have some experience in that, working at Luxus, working on the pairings there. Wheat is, I mean, when you talk about wheat in general, right, you can include everything from Berliner to Lambic to Belgian wit to, you know, American wheat, German Hefe. So really it's a completely versatile ingredient. There's even wheat double IPAs that you could throw on there. But if you're talking, you know, Winter White, Oberon, kind of that more straightforward in the consumer realm of understanding what wheat is, then I really like it as sort of a light starter. We have a range of snacks that we do as our first course, and you need something that's truly really versatile, that can, you know, play off earthiness, or it could play off acidity, or, you know, whatever other bright flavors might come in one snack to the next. And so wheat's really great for that.
For me too. I mean, when I had a pairing when I was in doubt, like a friend said, what should I pair with wild Alaskan salmon? I said, you know, for me, when in doubt, a German wheat is what I would pair with food, because I do feel like it's very food friendly. So I think that's a. I'm glad we had this conversation about wheat, which is funny that from the glassware we're talking about wheat, and I think that we'll probably have a lot more talks about wheat beers this winter because it's getting me turned on. It used to be one of my favorite styles, you know. And James, what about you? What are some wheat beers that you like?
Oh, I mean, I think Schneider is obviously world class. So I like that one a lot. I mean, going through the gamut, if you talk about certain Berliner Weisses, I mean, Peekskill, they do a fine one, Simple Sour, which got a write up in the Times, and I guess now it's kind of got a little cult following as well. There's, you know, a brewery in Michigan, Kalamazoo, that makes some decent wheat beers too.
So. Did we pop that just now? What is that, Jolly? Is that Jolly Pumpkin? Calabaza Blanc, is that?
Yeah, that's Brent.
That's the other one.
we had the Kalamazoo local bells here, and then it was you know, figured another Michigan brewery, Traverse City, Jolly Pumpkin.
All right, and John, anything else you want to say about your book that's coming out?
It was a blast to do. You know, I don't know. it's a blast to do. I learned a ton about malt. I hope people who read it do the same.
When is it going to be out?
I think mid December.
December 10th.
December
10th?
Pre-order
on Amazon.
Okay, all right, there you go.
Thank you.
Malt, the practical guide for field to brew house. And Justin, anything you want to say at the end of the show?
No, thank you for having me.
You got a new place opening up maybe soon?
Yeah, we'll talk about that next time.
Another time, all right. Brandon, congratulations on Torska, the Michelin star.
Thank you.
So I think it was a big part to you. Your service that you give. And
oh, yeah,
pairing.
You know, Chef Daniel Burns had nothing to do with it.
All right. And Laura, nice to have you in New York City. Anything else you want to say about?
No, we just appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
So. Well, this is a really special show. It's our second show with Matthew and Spiegel Out Glasses, and I want to thank everyone for joining me. Coming up soon in New York City, you know, New York City Beer Week is going to be in February. We've got a couple great things happening in December. There's a bunch of Belgian events. Mug's Ale House, Jimmy's Number 43 are doing different Belgian events on December 6th. So that's a good thing for our listeners to check out. I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com who've helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to Matthew, John, Laura, James, Brendan, and Justin. Did I get everybody? All right. For joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network, I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Maggie Seiden and Justin Kennedy, and to our engineer, Jack Inslee. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.